So he got behind in his contract, and they told him that, well, you know, you have to pay a fee every day that the ship is not launched. Mm-hmm. There's a technical name for it, but I don't know what the name of it is. So he went out east and talked to these people, and he told them, he says, you people realize that I build a good ship. He said, I put more into a ship than what other shipbuilders do.
Mm-hmm.
He said, my ships will last. Well, this was really true. His ships did last. So they said, okay, they realized he was a good shipbuilder. They knew that he had never fell behind in his contract before. They said, okay, we won't charge you any interest or mm-hmm. put this fee on you. So they wrote him a clean bill of sale. And they gave him money. They backed him to give him some more money. So he went back into business, and just a short time later he had labor problems again. And this time they were very serious. They lasted quite a while. Then these interests just took over the shipyards, and they called it the West Bay City Shipbuilding Company. And that began the end, of the shipbuilding era, because it only lasted about 8 to 10 years after that, mm-hmm. and then it was done. But to get back to the ships, for instance, the Pick River, this is a Canadian-owned ship now, but it was built by Frank Wheeler in 1896, and as of the year 1970, it was still sailing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many other ones. There's the Otto M. Reese. It was built by the West Bay City Shipbuilding Company in 1906. It was originally launched at the James S. Dunham. It's going to be scrapped this year. It's already been sold for scrap. Then there's the Sylvania. She was built here and launched as a Sylvania in 1905. She's still sailing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, of course, the Clifford Hood. It was built here as the Bransford in 1902. And it's still sailing. And I can go on for a few more, but I don't think they're all that interesting or not. But many of these ships were built from the Niagara, which is one of the most famous ones on the Saginaw River. I think everybody would like to take and give it a hit with a hammer once or twice for being stopped by it. It makes 3-4 trips a day up and down the river. But that was built here in 1897, and it has kept its original name right along.
Mm-hmm.
But all these ships were originally designed for the ore trade, to carry iron ore out of the lakes. And, of course, the larger your ship, the more profit you have. In these early days, there was no ice breaking, so they used to try to cram in as many sailing days as they could. And of course, in November, you have a lot of storms. The last ship to sink in a storm like this was the Daniel J. Morrell, which was built here. And so these ships really lasted. Then the canals, of course, the bigger the Sioux locks were, the bigger your ships. 600 footers. Mm-hmm. Now they're building them 1,000 feet long.
Wow.
Defoe is building a bow section for a barge, which will be 1,000 foot long. Mm-hmm. So you can see many of these older ships don't have long to last, because they're, like I said, they're almost being doubled in size and capacity.
Uh-huh.
But they all played a very important part on the development of the Upper Peninsula.
Well, what about we talked in the lectures in class about the types of ships. Now, we discussed the schooners and the freighters and things, but what about this whaleback? I'd like to know a little bit more about that. I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
That was developed by a guy by the name of McDougall, mm-hmm. it's pronounced. And he had the theory that by building this whaleback and keeping it low in the water, that you could make better headway in storms, and it was, of course, riding lower down.
Now, these were used just specifically for the ore trade?
And grain.
Mm-hmm.
They had one disadvantage. They were they really took a beating in a storm. Their decks were constantly awash.
Mm-hmm.
You could never get from one end of the ship to the other. Where on these regular ore carriers, you have a lifeline that would go the length of the ship. They would put a snap on there.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord willing, you made it to the other end.
Yeah.
But these ships being so low in the water, they're constantly awash. And if they're out in a storm, let's say for three or four days, nobody could even go out.
Mm-hmm.
But there was quite a few of them built, but they weren't very practical because at ore docks they have these things called halibut loaders, like great big clamshell buckets, and they work on a big arm, they reach out, they look like a grasshopper almost, reach out and they go down in the hole of the ship. Well, these buckets, of course, are straight, and they're like a clamshell, like a little clamshell bucket. And with the regular frigate, you have straight sides and you have your ballast tanks. Now, there, where these buckets can get right down in there, can scrape even at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Where with these whale backs being rounded, there's a lot of ore in the space on the side that these buckets just couldn't get to. And they say that iron ore is one of the best cargoes to handle because once it's settled down and it stays right there, it will not roll and shift like grain and other ores. But once it gets wet, it's very, just like mud, it'll slosh back and forth. So, you take one of these ships going, like, let's say, from Duluth down to, let's say, Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long ways. By then, that ore is pretty well packed, and there's a certain amount of water gets into the little ships. So, that ore would be really hard, and it would more or less hang up on the sides. And they had all kinds of problems unloading them. Other than that, I don't know that much about them. This is just what people have told me that I inquired.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, none of them were ever built here in Bay City.
No, they never? None at all?
No, none at all. This was just something that was built here in the freshwater whales. There is some material on whale backs. I'm not exactly sure where it's was located. Here's a picture right here of the steamer Albert H. Gray. This shows these buckets unloading into the ship. You see how they can get close to the sides?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Where on a whale back, that would be all round,
mm-hmm.
and your bucket just couldn't get in there to scoop.
Mm-hmm. Looks like a big cigar is what they look like.
Yeah. They called them pigs and everything
pigs.
Else. They look like a pig floating in the water. But,
are the lakes really that treacherous, as far as...
Oh, yes.
It seems like they would be nothing compared to the oceans or something, the big seas, but...
They, in a book that I have in my collection, it's called... Freshwater Fury. It's written by... the author here by Frank Barcus, Barcus, and this is the story of the 1913 storm in which 251 sailors were lost. It's one of the biggest and most destructive storms on the Great Lakes, and it's unbelievable. The stories that they tell in here, some of these ships were literally picked up and turned right around. They said at one time the wind, like for example, was blowing out of the northwest at gale proportions, and the sea was running south. The wind would turn that quick, and they said that they didn't know what to do. They just put it in the hands of the Lord and hope for the best.
Uh-huh.
This one captain said that they had their whistles. Of course, all the ships that were caught out there had their whistles tied down, so it'd be blowing constantly. He said you couldn't even hear your own whistle on your ship blowing.
Mm-hmm.
The wind was that strong, it was blowing the sound out. And he looked out of the pilot house window and he seen this big freighter coming right in front of him. He said, well, this was it. He said he closed his eyes and opened up, and the freighter was gone as he sailed up him. The wind was that strong. And he found out later, he was telling this story, and his captain said, well, that was my ship. He said, I did the same thing I seen you. And he says, we both of them couldn't do anything. It's just these lakes. This book, Freshwater Fury, I think is one of the most chill-raising books I've ever read. The stories in there are just unbelievable. And a lot of Bay City ships were in these storms,
mm-hmm.
And they came out quite well. James Dunham was one, and Centurion. That's an interesting ship that was built by Wheeler. It was his 100th ship that he built.
Now, we talked earlier before we started the interview, per se, that the wooden ships were perhaps a little bit better for sailing in that type of weather, but exactly why was that, you know?
I'm just going by what Mr. Davidson has said. He said that they could take the pounding better. The only thing I could figure out is that wood, of course, is more elastic than what oak and what steel would be.
Uh-huh.
Steel will just give so far and then it's gone. Now these wooden ships, don't get me wrong, they weren't just wood. They were literally crossed with iron. I've got pictures in my collection here from the Davidson, some of Davidson's ships. You can see them here in this book called the Great Lakes Wooden Shipbuilding Era. They have some ships in here, and you can see this diagonal crossing is steel.
Oh yes.
Uh-huh. This steamer happens to be the Tampa. Mm-hmm. Which was built by Frank Wheeler, and I mean this strengthened it. Also, this is the only thing I figured, that wood is more elastic; it can give more.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's upon the rocks, it'll just literally pound to pieces. I've read stories where these wooden ships have, let's say, got up on a reef, and the waves had just pounded them till there was nothing left. Where a steel ship would hold up because you've got this built stronger steel, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Stronger than wood.
Oak, yes. Mm-hmm.
But, of course, then you take a smaller ship, a 300-foot ship, there's not that much given, but you take a 600-foot ship, you've got twice the distance in there, and you've got a lot more twisting action.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, all Great Lakes ships are riveted, because a rivet can stretch, a steel does, in these storms will stretch in flux, where a weld is a solid weld, and the minute it's put a lot of tension, it breaks open.
Snaps. Mm-hmm.
But they say that in one of my books I've read where these ships have passed in a big storm and they're so close that rivets, they could, you know, see them hit the water, busting mm-hmm. off these ships.
We've talked about the industry now in Bay City and how the two build up as one, but why? What was the reason, the basic reasons that the industry declined in Bay City? As far as what I mean is that the Davidson Yards and the Wheeler Yards gave way, and now in Bay City we have the DeFoe Shipbuilding Company. And why did the two and the smaller yards that we talked about, of course they were kind of minute in comparison to the two big ones, the Davidson and the Wheeler, but why did they all of a sudden at the beginning of the century just kind of fade into nothingness? I mean, what were the reasons behind it?
Well, first of all, Davidson would not go into steel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if did I mention that about the reason why he stated?
I don't believe so.
He said that he realized in 1889, he said that the wooden shipbuilding era is finished.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's no longer. He says the oak cannot aim for it. You cannot build the ships big. You compare a 300-foot ship to a 600-foot ship. He realized this, that the wooden shipbuilding was out, and he would not go in shipbuilding. He already had made his money, and he figured, well, this is it. And of course, Wheeler, he had what they call a floating dry dock. It was not a permanent dry dock.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe if he would have had a permanent concrete dry dock as Davidson did, that his shipyard, the shipyard would have lasted here a lot longer. But being he did not have a permanent dry dock, this was a great disadvantage. And then also, the American Shipbuilding Company bought out these yards, and everything was moved down to Lorain, Ohio, into Cleveland. So it's just something that it's like any other industry today. You know, why did Bay City Shovels move out? You know,
mm-hmm.
Of course, there's labor problems. They had very serious labor problems here in Bay City. the shipbuilders here, when I talk about the shipbuilders, I mean right now the steel shipbuilders, were getting paid a lot less per rivet put in than what they were down in Detroit and down in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this had a big factor. And at the beginning of the 1900s, the unions took over. And of course, this was a big problem. They said a man should get a fair day's pay for what the work he does. Well, of course, these companies couldn't, a lot of them couldn't do it, and they just folded up. And the big problem was the union here. Then Defoe, he started, of course, building these small boats, your knockdown type boats, and then your big yachts,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Of course, the most famous one left around is a presidential yacht that was built here,
mm-hmm.
taken over during the war.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite, Mr. Defoe was quite lucky because when he started building his steel ships, there were still a lot of riveters left around from the old American yards in town, and all these men had experience at building ships. It was told to me that Defoe builds one of the best Navy vessels of any yard in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the class that he builds is one of the best built. But on a whole, I say that the labor problem was the biggest defeat of the shipyards.
Well, then Davison too had labor problems then.
Not that many. He was almost out of business by that time.
Mm-hmm.
His workforce was so low. But for example, let's take 1901 or 1900. Davison only built a tug and a wooden barge, of course, and a wooden steamer.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wheeler, on the other, the West Bay City Shipbuilding Company, on the other hand, they, let's see, I get my figures. They built a few more than that. He built just two steel ships. They built two steel ships that was launched in 1900. Now you figure they probably had a couple on the way because it took a while to build a steel ship.
Mm-hmm.
Because all these, my uncle worked at the American yards and he explained how they'd have to take these steel beams and have to bend them. Of course, this was done on big tables, but and all these plates had to be molded just right, and it wasn't like it was today.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably had a couple already underway. These two that he built in 1900, the Isaac Elwood and the William Edinburgh, were probably already started in the year 1899, and of course launched in 1900, mm-hmm. and there was probably two or three on the go then.
Mm-hmm. Well, it took, after they were launched, it took another year or so anyway to get them ready to go though, didn't it?
No. Most of the times they launched them, and within a very short time, within a matter of maybe a month or two, they were already on their way out.
Oh, I was under the impression that once they were in the water, even after that, it took quite a while to get
them
fitted.
All they had to do was the finishing touches. Most of the time, they were ready to take right off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In many cases, they were only, I've run across where they've launched them in the sand on Monday, then by the following Monday, they were already on their way out.
Mm-hmm.
But this is wooden ships that weren't big steamers.
So then you could almost say that Wheeler's problem stemmed from labor, and Davison's problem stemmed from his plain refusal to go into steel ships. Then.
Mm-hmm.
He just kind of declined. Of course, he had made his millions anyway. He didn't too much.
So, of course, Davison had his own interest, a ship line interest.
Mm-hmm.
The Davison Steamship Company, and Wheeler didn't. So
he had another business going.
On the side that was making his money for him besides.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Mr. Don Comtis, Director, Saginaw River Marine Historians. Thank you.